and restraint as well. All of these come at a time when church and state are being separated. So that this system of God more and more takes the place of religious, Christian, church-inspired system of thought. And therefore it becomes ever more materialistic, ever more anti-theological, because in the Enlightenment, the separation of church and state was one of the chief tenets, one of the chief and most deeply held beliefs. So that whole system was anti-theological, ever more materialistic. And it stressed, therefore, ever more the primacy of the body. And it was ever more centered, the brief revival had to do something with it as well, on the primacy of the body. And therefore, we witnessed a transition from the description of immorality, abnormal, immorality in theological terms. Immorality is a sin. You confess it to your father confessor. Your father confessor can give you absolution. The church can lead you to conversion from immorality to morality. But with the 18th century and the rise of the medical profession, immorality and abnormality become a disease. And as they become a disease, they become fixed categories. As you will see in a minute, categories which are no longer subject to conversion, to absolution, by indeed physical diseases. By 1840, the medical profession had emancipated itself from theology. And medicine was no longer linked to theological concerns of sin, of absolution, of salvation. But the medical profession had emancipated itself. But at the same time, by the mid-1870s, Pasteur and Koch had proved the germ theory of disease. So that disease was something material. It wasn't something moral. Ever since 1840, since the rise of the germ theory of disease, which Pasteur and Koch finally proved by the middle of 1870, disease was no longer a moral thing. It was, in fact, a physical thing. And therefore, the medical profession, becoming the custodian of manners and morals in many ways, underlined the materialism of this idea of thought. This is very well explained by the idea of criminality of the 19th century, an idea of criminality put forward in Italy by Cesare Lombroso, but became a general eventually. That is to say, criminality, sexual perversion, any abnormality is a physical disease. Habitual criminals can be identified by physical abnormality. Lombroso thought these were large candle-shaped ears, large neck, yes, and a receding forehead. In other words, and that meant that habitual criminals must be executed. Because if criminality is a physical disease, then no rehabilitation is, of course, possible. So that you get the idea of a physical disease. And you get, therefore, again, the linkage between the external and the internal. And you get it around the world, a new term, which typifies all of this, which Lombroso uses, but which was invented by a French doctor, a physician earlier, the word degeneration. That is to say, from now on, what was not known, what did not fit in with reason, the strength, the type of beauty that we have talked about, or that I have mentioned, the type of behavior, manners, and morals, that was thought to be degenerate. And degeneration was, in fact, a disease, and nothing that could be solved anymore by the father, confessor. The man who invented the term degeneration, which will be so important from now on, a French physician by the name of Morel, who invented it in 1857, defined it as follows. Poisoning the bodily system by alcohol, narcotics, stimulants, and the like, and above all by a diseased nervous system. I shall come back to that eventually, because that will be eventually the chief sign of degeneration. A diseased nervous system, but also a diseased social environment. That is, a social environment leading to bad habits, to alcohol, to stimulants, to drugs, and above all, to deterioration of the nervous system. Now, before that already, to make it still more clear to you, a doctor by the name of Broca in Italy had sought to cure mental diseases by an operation which may be familiar to some of you. Broca believed in 1861 that you could cure mental disorders by operating the frontal lobe of the brain. That is what is called lobotomy, still done today. But then he thought that through a physical operation, lobotomy, you could cure a mental disease. Now this, in fact, is what we must now call the pre-Freudian psychology. It is a materialistic psychology in which the body is foremost, in which the doctor is the guardian of normality. This will not change. I need not have to tell you that for Sigmund Freud, the psychoanalyst is the guardian of normality. That is to say, Sigmund Freud continued that tradition very strongly. The whole trend even of Freudian psychoanalysis is to adjust to normality. So there is really no change in this particular, of course, at all. The doctor is the guardian of normality, and what is deviant is structural. This is true for deviant sex. I won't bother you with it, but the most famous work in this regard, Klaus Ebbing's Psychopathia Sexualis of 1877, simply puts it this way: all sex is perversion which does not further reproduction. In other words, it takes the Christian view of sex now on a medical plane. Everything that does not further reproduction is perversion. That is the biblical view of sex, as you know, the Christian and Jewish view of sex. And so now it is put on material things. Those who go further are obviously sick. The influence of Darwinism on this is important. Darwin published, of course, his Origin of the Species in 1859. And the Origin of the Species, with its environmentalism, greatly encouraged the material basis of this system of thought. Darwin believed, I just remind you, that evolution is governed, and I quote, by the indirect and direct action of conditions of life, and from use and disuse. Only much later did he add hereditary factors. In the Origin of the Species, everything is due to environmentalism, everything is due to the environment, from the conditions of life, from use and disuse. At the same time, of course, man is descended, as you know, from the ape, man himself evolved in a material effect. So that here again, science seems to support a materialist and environmentalist, which defines normalcy and defines the disease. I'll come back to that in a minute. For normalcy is adjustment to progress, adjustment to evolution. And abnormal is the contrary. This will be the center of a book I'm going to talk about in a minute, normal degeneration. For example, let us say, if the giraffe neck had not grown and stretched with the necessity of food and the evolution, that its food was growing higher and higher, it obviously would have become weak and died. So obviously, following evolution, which in our system means following progress, following the progress of science, politics, and commerce, and art, and that means stress. And being against normalcy means degeneration, means obviously weakness, as you will see, I think, in a minute. Now this kind of materialism, on which, as I say, is based a system of thought, an idea of reason, which is equated with judgment and balance and restraint, with great beauty, with manners and morals, with the middle class society, in fact, of Jenny Kreiber, that could go to extremes. In one way, Darwin's followers, whereas followers always are, more extreme than the master. Huxley in England, for example, believed that the advance of science would extend the realm of matter until matter is coexist with knowledge, with feeling, and with action. And he adds, typically enough, this great truth weighs on us as a nightmare. Well, the problem with this system is, of course, clear. If man's brain, man's whole reason, everything, is dependent on material facts, his biological makeup, his chemical juices, then where is human evolution? Man is, as Huxley once put it, determined by its juices. Thus the problem for the end of the century is, of course, a problem of free human creativity. And indeed, this kind of materialism plays into the hands of a romantic reaction that must be clear. Take, for example, the denial of the possibility of genes by positivists and positivists. And indeed, in Jenny Kreiber, this is quite clear. It is the average, the normal, that is wanted. There could be no genius, surely, at that dinner party at the tribal house. Lombroso believed, straightly, that genius is madness, to give you the title of his most important book of 1887, that genius is madness. And the Frenchman Lassard put it, genius is an illness of the nervous system. Now, of course, the reaction is clear. I can put it by a phrase of Carl Gustav Jung, the psychoanalyst whom you will read much later, that the psychic need of people is best meant by poets. This is about the other extreme of Carl Jung's eventual idea that the psychic needs of people are best met by poets. Here, of course, they are best met by your friendly family doctor. Now, all of this is summed by Max Noth. In the one book that did most to spread all of these ideas, which in its time was a runaway bestseller all over Europe, and the title, Spread a Phrase, which was always used by the Nazis in the famous exhibition of degenerate art. It contains one of the favorite phrases, namely his famous book, Indeed, Degeneration. And it is through that that I now want to look at this idea of it will become and summarize it in a way. Now, Max Nordau himself was a very interesting guy. His real name had been Südfeld, Southern Field, and he changed it to Nordau, which means Northern Metal, in his reaction against Hungary, where he was born, perfectly understandable, I think. He also was a doctor, but he also wrote, I think, 9 volumes of essays, 5 rather dreary novels, practice, father and daughter, I know her, a crazy painter, and became at the end of his life the Zionist organizer of the second rehearsal. He never believed in it, was for him a matter of charity, and died eventually during the First World War. Now, the cornerstone of his worldview, in his most famous book, was a belief in an ordered progress. That is again the word of ordered progress. And based on what? On the natural science. By the way, in what I've told you now, or today, you will see how the physician got such an abnormally high status in our society. It is, of course, totally undeserved. Why he got such an abnormally high estate in our society, why he became the kind of president of modern society. And this is how it came about, with all these terrible attendant evils like the American Medical Association. Yes. Now, the cornerstone, therefore, of Nordau's worldview was a belief in ordered progress based on the natural science. That won't surprise you. The future of humanity lies in its elevation, he said, not in its degradation. Ideas based upon the natural sciences will enable humanity to see the distant development more clearly than superstition. Natural sciences is in turn with evolution, not out of the dumb. And as we know that evolution determines the future, so natural science determines the future. So our thought cannot be involved in superstition, but it must be based on science and progress. They go together. He never had any doubt that they go together. Very few of these middle-class people had any doubt that science and progress go together. Nor do many Americans, because America is retarded in this regard, reasons that I can't go into. Now, in degeneration, Nordau explains that science operates through unchanged laws which apply to man and nature. Here are your Darwinist laws. We are all the creatures of unchanged laws of nature, which determine evolution, which apply to man as well as to nature. And how do we discover these laws? These laws are based on reason. What does that mean? They are based on the laws of cause and effect. And if we have discipline, if we are normal people, and if we reason normally, we can discover these laws, as Darwin did, because we are not distracted from thinking in terms of cause and effect. That is the center of it all. Thus, our relationship between things and between men must be clearly formulated. There is no room for romanticism here. There is no room for mysticism. Mysticism, romanticism, simply fudge these clear laws of cause and effect on which science, progress, evolution is based. There must be clear formulation. There is no doubt for Nordau, for example, that Tolstoy is one of the degenerates because of his mysticism. No doubt whatsoever. But Nordau's worldview involves a great deal more than merely clarity of formulation. For man achieves clarity only through observation and knowledge. Observation and knowledge means discipline. Up, straight, equal, discipline. Observation, knowledge, discipline. And knowledge means discovering the laws of cause and effect. So discipline is of the center here. Discipline and clarity. As Nordau put it, whoever preaches the absence of discipline is an enemy of progress. Whoever preaches the absence of discipline is an enemy of progress. The knowledge acquired through discipline and hard work is a knowledge of nature, and that shapes the future of the human species. It depends, therefore, on the recognition of irresistible organic law, the law of cause and effect, which leads to the law of evolution, the law of progress, the law of nature. But once we have discovered the law of evolution, what have we really discovered? We have discovered that evolution is dominated by the survival of the fittest, by the struggle for existence, by the enterprise, by the struggle for existence, and by the survival of the fittest. And what does that mean again? What does that mean? That means man must face the problem of existing reality. He must adjust himself to the struggle. He must adjust himself to survival by moving with progress, by rejecting, as it were, anything that interferes with that kind of progress and those kinds of law. He himself was not always consistent on this, but that was his general message in that book. Now, here you can see Nordau's objection to all of what he called modern literature and art. For Degeneration is a book written against all of modern literature and modern art. Modern writers and artists of his time, he called mystics and egomaniacs. They withdraw from the task at hand. They do not care for the task in hand. For what does all of this mean? It means something very simple in the cultural realm. You cannot invent new artistic forms any more than you can invent new political. Everything is in a way predestined by the laws of natural science. That is what Engels and the Bolsheviks mean by scientific Marxism. Scientific Marxism isn't invented by Marx. It's predestined by the laws of science. And that is, of course, what Nordau means here. New artistic forms cannot be invented. In a sense, as I hope you see, everything must be due to organic growth. Therefore, obviously, Nordau opposes political revolution. Sudden breaks with the past are not in tune with evolution, are not in tune with Darwinism. After all, he suggested liberal reform. And the liberal reform is always the same, from Lloyd George in 1910 to all liberals, an inheritance tax. In other words, everybody must be equal at the starting line. Yes? Everybody must be equal at the starting line, for if you don't do that, you have the danger of perpetuating degeneracy through inheritance. So an inheritance tax is a liberal measure because it makes everybody equal. And those who think clearest will win the race. Those who think in terms with them. And the egomaniacs, the mystics, like Tolstoy or even Zola, not to talk about Ibsen and others, they are the losers. Therefore, the reform is always an inheritance text. That is true for Lloyd George in 1910, to Roosevelt and the New Deal. it is part of the whole bourgeois system. And so, that is clear. The idea is of always dedication, duty to work, and to discipline. Now, what must be denied, therefore, is also clear: progress in literature and art. There cannot be any attempt to self-liberation. That, no doubt, thing led to chaos, to utter chaos. And so he goes down the list and condemns everybody of the modern. He classifies them in three classes again. They are the egomaniacs, who are involved with themselves, who don't know how to observe anything except their own soul. These egomaniacs would be visiting the people who want to abolish or change manners and morals. Basically, would be in that case, in this idea, all of this kind. Then the other mystics, those who are religious, those who are theological, like Tolstoy. Yes? And then there are what he calls the misleader, the false realist. Who are the false realists? A man like Roger, the sculptor, because he sculpts muscles where there are none in reality. Yes? Or Ibsen, because he paints so-called realistic pictures which are quite untrue. In Ghosts, we will talk about those later, the hero is after all a syphilitic, a degenerate in Northern Church. Yes? And in fact, in the Ghosts, they are all degenerate. So it is not a play that should ever have been written. So what you have therefore here then is a condemnation of all of the modern. We come back again to not out a famous summary which I quoted to you I think last time already. Egomaniacs, mystics, misleaders if you like, artists who paint things where there are none in reality, or things of this sort, who have plays around degeneracy. These are the opposites of normal men, upon whom has not often been human progress depend. Those who rise early and are not weary before sunset. Those who have clear heads, solid stomachs, and hard muscles. Now here again you have everything. It is always connected with thought. Solid stone, which is really the Greek idea of beauty, put in another way. Not fair, not short, but solid stone. And those who have solid stomachs and hard muscles, they are like the Greek sculptor. Everybody, after all, admires so much. Clear heads. You need observation. And you need discipline. And you need the realization that man is a part of the laws of evolution. That what you call normalcy is really progress. And that without that normalcy, there can be no progress. And that normalcy means restraint, discipline. And that discipline means the right manners and more. It means the whole kind of society which you have in Jesus Christ. These ideas grew up, not suddenly, but they grew up after all over a century. They come from the Enlightenment of the 18th century. They correspond to a reality of bourgeois enterprise. The reality of getting ahead in this world, they correspond to a reality, or they would never have been so strong. This is indeed the way you got ahead in the world. They correspond to a reality, and they correspond as a reply to the more rapid passage of time, to the disorientation of industrialization. And the disorientation of industrialization and all that this disorientation of industrialization really meant, if you like, all that that disorientation really was meant to imply. But it is clear here that there is a very limited, perhaps no room for human creativity. That there is, of course, no room at all for human genius. Now, all of this should be very familiar to you if you don't know it. We'll come back to that in a minute, because this system is strong in America, very strong in America today. And it has led, even in history, to the positivism, to the quantifier, to the computer. It has led, of course, in history, to history without people. You can say this system is a system without people. But in America, it is extremely strong, because America is, in a way, the last intact post-war society in the Western world. How much longer this will last in the age of scarcity, I don't think it will. You may see the change. But up to now, it is still, perhaps, together with Western Europe or possibly the strongest post-war society. So that we have that very odd picture that it is in America, not in Europe. But in America, that positivism again runs riot among intellectuals. And it is no coincidence that the new social science history comes after the student of all. It is another attempt to find a resting place. A bit unrest. It's another attempt as this attempt that I'm explaining to you here. Now, I'm not knocking it too much, it's extremely useful, but it has become for many people a thing in itself, an explanation. Statistics as an explanation that only within a positive world rule which tries again, as it were, to find some resting place in a world that is severely disturbed. And I think you can make a direct link between the rise of statistical department in universities in America and the students of the whole of the 60s. So what you have therefore here is clear that it is built, of course, into industrial rationalization. And in a sense, I should tell you back here, what I'm going to later, that all that I've talked about, which comes back to again, because it is inherent in industrialization, this process of rationalization, as Max Weber put it quite rightly, this process of rationalization, of which, if you like, this system is also a manifestation. You can put it this way, if you like, that what I've discussed up to now is a manifestation of two things. It's a manifestation of a response to industrialization. But it is also a manifestation of the rationalization process which is inherent in industrialization. A materialism, a process of materialism, which Marxism would better fit, a process of the fetishization of goods, a process of fetishization, of rationalization, that is inherent, that comes out here, comes out in Darwinism. We couldn't have Darwinism outside the age of industrialization either. But all of this is unsatisfactory to the post-war. Look at Jenny Cryer. Jenny would never have accepted such a world. Jenny, being merely a creature of natural laws, Jenny has a soul, as she makes clear to Willibald Schmidt. To be sure, it is a soul which has to be a limit, but then every soul has to be a living, you know? You can do it. So, what is missing? What is missing is the sentence. Well, the doctrine of Donar is too hard. The Jenny tribal, the settled born one thing, it's one culture, it's one higher thing. Jenny, the furniture of the tribal, does not include Peter Star. Or skeletons showing evolution, yes? It includes higher things, painting, fine manners and moral ritual. Well, you can say that ritual is part of clear observation, because the ritual of the dinner party is, of course, quite clear. There are no, what Ezra Pound called, forms of wobble, but then it's right at dinner. There's nothing like that. All this is obviously quite clear. So you can say, yes, but still, isn't it clear that Jenny wants higher things? Jenny wants higher. And so, by the 1880s, this system becomes enveloped in a cocoon of a new religion, in a cocoon of a new sentimentality. But really, it is better, it becomes itself a religion. All this materialism, this evolution, these human juices, these doctors, this biology, all this itself is lifted into a new religion by another book. A book that became a runaway bestseller, much more than Degeneration, because Jenny Tribal would not read Degeneration. Jenny Tribal would certainly read, and every bourgeois that generation did, Haeckel's Riddle of the Universe. Haeckel's Riddle of the Universe of 1899, which sums up a whole development. It puts the finishing touches on positivism, the religious touches on positivism, the national touches on positivism, which makes, if you like, positivism and sentiment compatible. Positivism and sentiment compatible. Whatever you say, you can worship your priest, you can't in the same way worship your doctor. But after Haeckel, the new priest became the scientist, especially the biologist, the zoologist, the new high priest, the scientist, the zoologist, the scientist. And we must therefore now look at Haeckel's Riddle of the Universe. I dare say that your grandparents, or would it by now be great grandparents, in 1899, have read Haeckel. I'm sure that if you have an old family library, and you look in that old family library, you will, can you want, find a copy of Haeckel's Riddle of the Universe in any damn language you can think about. Because it, of course, satisfies several things. It satisfied on a popular level the quest everybody has to get to know the riddle of the universe. The omniscience of riddles of the universe. And not just the condemnation of modern artists, not just an exhortation to discipline, but what the hell is the riddle of the modern universe? And it gave a nice answer. The answer was essentially that the riddle of the universe both materialistic and religious. That any tribe who can have a talk and can yet understand the laws of evolution. That, in fact, matter has another dimension. That matter isn't, as we all thought, merely material, but that matter indeed has a religious dimension. And it is, in fact, only science that can grasp the mystery of faith. And that, therefore, if you look again at this kind of science, you really come back to a new kind of faith. For after all, we do not know how matter came about. And here Haeckel simply goes back to Diderot. He simply goes back to the 18th century. And the paints what Diderot said. Somebody asked Diderot, how does matter transform itself or transmit itself? And Diderot, sitting in front of a fire, many of you know the story, took one coal and lit it from another and said that's how matter transmits itself. There is a mystical component. The component of fire. Well, for Haeckel, as you will see, it is the sun. In other words, there is a mystical component in matter, because the origins of matter are mysterious. And so, in every molecule, in every little part of scientific matter, name. Fifth is a mystical dimension which comes from his word. And that mystical dimension transmits itself to the human soul. Without abrogating the natural law. Without abrogating the natural law. And that human dimension, for Hegel, is the dimension of wonder, of awe, of sensation. He says the dimension of the sun. Well, it is a German quality for him. He's a nationalist, he's a racist, he's a dictator. It is the quality of the sun. And so that you can, as a matter of fact, have side by side materialism and reverence. Materialism and the soul. Materialism and religion. Materialism and wonder. Materialism and worship. Not for Christ, not for the Bible, but for the Son, for the great universe, as the origin of all things, for nature as the temple. That will be very important at the end of the Tour Mount, which I can see you on Monday. This is not only something for the bourgeoisie, this will not only give Jenny Tribal rule or sense, but eventually this is the doctrine for the working classes in Germany became much more important than Marxism. German workers got their doctrine of progress from this idea of Hegel's movement to which we will come, which is called monism, from the idea of progress, which is part of the temple of nature, and that is the break, the temple of nature. According to natural laws, yet reinforced side by side with a new man. A new man, good, kind, and attuned to the laws of evolution. A person of sentiment as well as a person of discipline. In other words, Hegel added to Darwin the dimension of religion. And this then comes, first of all, from an analysis of the origin of matter, in which it goes back to the 18th century, to Diderot, to common 18th century thought about the origin of matter. It goes back to the origin of matter, and it combines the physical nature of matter, the physical nature of perversion, with a new kind of religious dimension. Perverts are children of darkness. They have no soul. Question. They have no soul. They are children of darkness. The habitual criminal, the sexual pervert, the abnormal. And so you get added to it. And Hegel would say the non-German. You get added to it. The idea is quite clearly here that there is to be degeneration in moral dimension. That's implied in Nordau, in a certain way. Nordau could obviously not be a racist of any kind, he was a liberal. But with Hegel, this becomes what's called the racist idea, very true, but not necessarily. In the working classes, it was not, as you will see next time, a racist idea at all. But it is an idea which talks then to end about the temple of nature. The temple of nature. It's both a matter of immutable laws of evolution, of clear thought, of the laws of cause and effect, of discipline, of going to bed early and rising early. But it is also a matter of having the sun within your soul. And that will make all the difference. It enables Jenny Tribal to size. And the world war without size is tribal. No lecture on Friday then. Miners of the neighborhood, the working class, the strikes, all of these things were foreseen through, if you like, the new speed of time. They were perceived above all.